Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Don Salvatore. He has a biology degree, BA, from Northeastern University in Boston. He's been an informal science educator since graduating, with the last 36 years at the Museum of Science in Boston, teaching many science topics to the general public and school groups that visit the museum. He's currently the coordinator of the Firefly Watch Citizen Science Project, which started in 2008. Since the program's beginning, they've had over 5,000 people from 40 states and 6 Canadian provinces participate, collecting firefly data in their backyards. He also writes short stories about the nature one can find in one's backyard and posts them on a website, Backyard Biology, www.backyardbiology.net. Today we talk about fireflies. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
So, can you give a basic introduction to fireflies? Who are they? What's their general distribution? How many species generally are there?
Sure. First of all, we call them fireflies, but they're not flies. We also call them lightning bugs. They're not bugs. They are beetles. So it's a group of beetles where I would say that there's probably 2,000 species worldwide, maybe about 120 to 150 species in the United States, more in the south than in the north. For instance, in Florida, I think there's 50, 60 species. There are not many in the West Coast, and most people on the West Coast have never seen them. So one of the things that defines them as a firefly is the ability to make light. Now, not all adult fireflies glow or flash, but all larval fireflies that we know about do.
And are they around the world as well?
Yes, there are plenty of fireflies in Asia, and they're quite common and quite popular and revered in parts of Asia. In Europe, there's not as many. If you go up to England, they have one species, and that's a glowworm, a type of firefly that does not flash. And again, here in the United States, as I said, we have about 120 to 150. They do have them in plenty of them in Central and South America, Africa, and so forth. So yes, they are found pretty much in every continent except Antarctic.
Can we make general statements about the type of habitat they like, or do the species vary in their choice of habitat?
We can make general statements, but with so many different species, and I'm mostly conversant with the ones here in the U.S. with the 120 or so species we have here.
Yeah, let's focus on those.
Sure. So typically you would tend to find that most people would see them in fields that border on woods that have a bit of moisture, and that's because the larvae are feeding mostly on earthworms, snails, and slugs, and you find more of them in wet areas. Also, if there's a field, a wet field with a lot of fireflies, people are much more likely to notice that than they would if they were in the middle of the forest, in the dark forest, although there certainly are fireflies there as well. And then there are other fireflies. There's one in Florida that lives in a salt marsh. There's fireflies that live mostly in the mountains in Arizona. And then there are even some that like more desert areas. But typically you would find most of them in wet, moist fields.
So you said a moment ago that they eat slugs and earthworms. And so this, as I said before we turned on the recorder, I grew up in the West, so my only experience of fireflies is when I've seen them when I happen to be in the South or the Midwest. So I don't know much about them, but I had heard that I want to talk in a moment about the decline of fireflies, but I want to say one thing first, which is I'd heard that part of the reason for their decline was a lack of dead wood in forests. I somehow presumed that the grubs ate dead wood, but that's obviously incorrect.
Yes, that is incorrect. They are carnivorous. The adults pretty much don't eat anything at all. Some of them may drink nectar from flowers. As far as dead wood goes, it might be that some of them lay their eggs in rotting dead wood. A lot of them will lay their eggs in moist moss, but they don't eat the wood, no.
So I can't tell you how many people I have met over the years who have said to me that My mom, for example, obviously I've met her. My mom grew up in Nebraska, and when she was a child, there were fireflies everywhere. And I can't tell you how many people I've met over the years who love fireflies so much, and they're wonderful memories from their childhood, but they also say that I don't see them like I used to.
I hear that all the time as well, and that's one of the reasons why we started this citizen science project, to have people count fireflies. Because, as you know, in science, there's anecdotal evidence. People say that all the time, but then you need data to back that up in order for that to really mean anything. And so we've had lots of people come up to us and say they haven't seen fireflies. So we started this Firefly Watch project to try to get some data. And so what we have people doing is going out in their backyard during the summer, during the firefly season, describing their backyard. First of all, this is all done online in our website called Firefly Watch. So they describe their backyard, what's the main type of vegetation, how often do they mow their lawns, do they put down weed killers, fertilizers, pesticides, how far from street lights, do they keep their back lights on, how far from water, this sort of thing. And then we ask them once a week to go out and count the number of fireflies they see in 10 seconds. Now, the counting is none, 1, 2 to 5, 6 to 20, or more than 20 in 10 seconds. So it's a very easy counting, but it gives us an idea of the numbers of fireflies people are seeing. So we've been doing this for 2008 and still have a long way to go, because firefly numbers do vary quite a bit from year to year. And we think that has a lot to do with the weather conditions somewhere in their life cycle. So their life cycle up here in the north, where I am in Massachusetts, is a two-year life cycle. So once the eggs are laid in the summer, once the eggs hatch, the larva will crawl underground and spend 2 years underground. And then at that point, they come up, they pupate to adults, and they come up, and they're alive for about 2 or 3 weeks, just long enough to mate. Down south, it's more of a year life cycle. Somewhere in that life cycle, we are trying to find out what is causing either a good year or a bad year. But other than that, what we really believe is firefly numbers are disappearing for a few well-known reasons, but not documented yet. The first reason is loss of habitat. So if you think of all the, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, all the old fields that were around that were moist and people weren't, people have developed those. They put on houses, parking lots, shopping malls. All of these things have disappeared. Also, people in many developments are developing lawns that are not conducive to fireflies. They're also putting down pesticides on their lawns to kill grubs that live under the ground. Well, we think this may be affecting the larval fireflies. And another reason could be light pollution. So fireflies communicate with light, and it's hard to go anywhere, especially in the eastern U.S., where there's not continual light somewhere at nighttime. So we want to find out how that's affecting their numbers as well. So what we find is if conditions are good, even in the middle of a city, fireflies could be plentiful. But the places where the conditions are good, we think, are rapidly diminishing. And so we think that's what's really causing the problem.
So do we have, when you talk about, what was the upper range for how many you can count in, what was it, 10 seconds?
More than 20.
More than 20. So that is, more than 20 in 10 seconds sounds delightful and wonderful.
Yes.
Do we have, when I was researching for this interview, I learned about some historical threats to fireflies too. Like they were captured for industry for, 20, 30 years? Do you know what I'm talking about? When they were captured
Yes, I do.
So can you talk about that for a moment?
Sure. The chemicals that produce the light, the luciferase and the luciferin. Luciferase is the enzyme that reacts with luciferin and oxygen to produce light. These were found, first of all, they were found to be able to identify living things. So, for instance, oxygen in the presence of ATP, if you add luciferin and luciferase, it'll cause a glow. Well, what they found was that if you're making a product like a medicine, you don't want it to be contaminated with bacteria. And one way to look for that bacteria is to add these chemicals and see if it will glow, because the bacteria has ATP, and so that's part of the reaction. So when you add the other compounds, it will react. They also found that these chemicals can be used in a number of other ways for research, for agricultural research and medical research. So there were some companies that were offering to buy fireflies, and particularly in the southeast, in Tennessee and so forth, people will get down there and offer a certain amount of money for 100 fireflies or whatever, and thousands were being collected. So we think this had obviously an impact on the numbers of fireflies. Today they've come up with synthetic versions of these chemicals, so they don't need to collect fireflies. However, we find there is still one person who lives out on the West Coast, of all places, and travels once a year in the summer to into Tennessee, I believe, and is paying for fireflies. We don't know what he's doing with them, or we can't find out who is buying them from him, but it is still going on, and this is a big concern. So we hope that it's not necessary, but we hope someday that we no longer have to worry about this sort of thing.
So when do we have, when I read accounts of San Francisco Bay when the Europeans first arrived, I've read accounts where the bay was, quote, paved with sea lions. And we've heard accounts from Audubon and from that time of passenger pigeons in flocks so large they darkened the sky for days at a time. And this is a total shot in the dark, no pun intended. But are there accounts of what fireflies were like prior to any of their collapses in population? You know, we get excited when we see 20 in 10 seconds. Are there any accounts of what they were like a long time ago?
I've never read any accounts. I just remember from my childhood. You know, I'm 64 years old, and I remember seeing lots of them. However, you can still, as I mentioned earlier, you can still go places where there are hundreds of fireflies in a field, thousands of fireflies, and it's just fantastic to watch. So I don't think we need to go back looking in historical records to see what firefly populations can be and how amazing it is to watch these. They do exist today. It's just the number of places where you see this is diminishing.
So let's go a different direction for a second. And I kind of hate to talk about utility in terms of the natural world, because sometimes we talk about function too much. But what are some of the roles that fireflies would play in a healthy field/forest community? Like bears, one of the things bears do is they will carry, salmon. Let's go salmon in a forest in the Pacific Northwest where I live. Salmon are a tremendous nutrient pump into the forest, and the forest derives tremendous benefit from all the salmon dead bodies. And then bears eat the salmon and they poop elsewhere to carry the nutrients around the forest. So, what are some of the things that fireflies provide to the community, and like who eats them? Are they, and do you see what I'm asking?
Yes, I do. So first of all, it's important to understand there aren't many people studying fireflies. When you think about how popular of an insect they are, and if you give people a list of insects and fireflies are on that list and say, which one is your favorite? Almost everyone would say fireflies, because especially here on the West Coast, it is a summer tradition for families to go out and for the kids to catch fireflies. I mean, I've talked to so many people that is one of their most fond summer memories. So surprising how few people are studying fireflies. As a matter of fact, up until just this year, there were no good natural history books on fireflies. There were children's books, but no real good natural history books. One just came out this year, written by a professor at Tufts University here in Massachusetts, Dr. Sarah Lewis. It's called Silent Sparks, and it's a wonderful book on fireflies, their natural history, and so for their biology, but it's the only one. A little bit later, actually beginning of next year in the spring, there'll be the first field guide to fireflies being written by a woman named Lynn Faust. So we're looking forward to that. So when you ask these types of questions, many of the answers are going to be, we don't really know because it hasn't been studied. One of the things that I do on our website is I take firefly research papers that you can find online and do a short 500-word synopsis of it in non-scientific language and publish that on our website. And we've had about 40 of those done so far. That's where we get our information from fireflies. But surprisingly few people are studying fireflies. So we don't know too much about the effects of fireflies in the environment, in their environment. One paper I read says that certain fireflies in Asia where they have a lot of aquatic fireflies, meaning the larvae are either aquatic, catching snails under the water or catching them right above the water, are important in keeping the snail population in check. In keeping the snail population, they studied the snail's effects on different crops. And with a healthy firefly population, the crops were able to grow better because there were fewer snails. But I haven't read any studies here in the United States. But I can give you some information on who eats fireflies and so forth. And the answer is not many things. Because fireflies are poisonous. They have in their blood a poison that's similar to the poison that you would find in toads. And so they call it a but when they are attacked, they will bleed from their leg joints and the carapace on purpose. And this blood is a white, sticky blood. So if a predator, like another insect, were to attack them, it would gum up their mouth, and it is it's toxic. And I've actually tasted one when I grabbed a firefly once that bled, and I stuck the blood in my finger and touched it to my tongue, and it was very, very bitter. So there are not many things that eat fireflies. In fact, it's believed that this ability to glow first evolved as a warning to predators and later evolved to what we think of today, the firefly doing, and that's a mating signal. Now, they do have one predator. Their main predator is another type of firefly. So around here, we have three main groups of fireflies that fly around and flash. We have Photinus, Photurus, and Pyractomina. Photurus is twice as big as Photinus and Photurus, but they don't make the poison. And this poison not only protects the adult firefly, it protects the larvae as well. And the larvae will glow. All firefly larvae glow, whether the adults do or not. The eggs can glow. And so in order to get this poison, these Photurus, these large ones, will attract the smaller Photinus and Pyractomina, and then eat them. And then they can sequester that poison themselves and use it for their own defenses. Now, the way they attract the fireflies, the Photinus and Pyractomina, is they imitate a female. So in firefly season, the males are flying, and they're flashing. They're trying to attract a female. The females are sitting. They're not flying. They're sitting there watching all the males. And they're looking for the one that's perfect for them. You know, the sexiest male firefly flying around. And when they see one, they will flash back. Now, when that male sees the female flash, he now knows where she is, and he will fly down to get to her. But in the beginning of a firefly season, there might be 50 times more males than females. And so the females can be very choosy. And then the males, since they're only alive for a few weeks as adults, they might only fly in a night for maybe 30, 40, 50 minutes, some of them longer, some of them shorter. And when there is so much competition, they're anxious to get down to that female as fast as they can because this is their purpose as an adult, is to find a female and mate. So they don't want to wait because other males may have also seen that female. They'll rush down there, and if they get there first, they might mate with her, and the chosen male might lose out. So each type of firefly has a specific flash pattern. And it's specific to that species. So one firefly might flash once every second. Another one might flash once every 4 seconds. Another one might have a double flash that's repeated every 6 seconds. Another one might have a long flash or a flicker or sort of a flash as they loop upwards. And so they can tell it's the right species, even if there are many species in the field at the same time. And the female also has a specific timed flash for that species. So these Photurus, these big ones, after they're done mating, they will fly to where the Photinus and the Pyracamina are, and when they see a male fly by, they imitate the female. And then the male sees the female Photurus. He thinks it's the Photinus, the one he's looking for. He flies down there, and of course he gets a big surprise. She grabs him and she eats him. So these are the main predators of fireflies. Many other animals will taste them once, spit them out, and if it doesn't kill them, they will learn not to eat anything that glows. So a lot of bats will stay away from them, birds, a lot of insects, a lot of spiders learn you don't mess with fireflies. They're slow, they're easy to find because they're glowing, but still, they're not a good meal.
So this is all incredibly fascinating. Thank you so much. And you said that there were like 50 males per female. Is that ratio from birth, or do the, I mean, so basically out of every 51 eggs, you know, roughly, obviously, 50 of those are male?
That's a good question that I don't think anyone knows. And the way they come up with that number is at the beginning of the season, they will collect all the fireflies they can find and count the males and the females. Now, the females may be there that they're not seeing, that are not responding, because in order for the scientist or the firefly male to see the female, she has to light up. But what they found when they sampled them, the ones that they've been able to see, in the beginning of the season, there are a lot more males than females. Now, what happens in many types of fireflies is the female is choosing based on the flash of the male. In some types, if the male's flash is a little bit longer than all the others of that species, that's the one she chooses. If it's a double flash and the time in between them is a little shorter than the other ones of that species, that's the one she chooses. And this has been studied in a few fireflies, but not a lot of them. And what that tells her is that when they mate, he's not only going to give her sperm, but he's also going to give her a package of protein called a nuptial gift. And this is in the mating process. So she wants the guy with the biggest nuptial gift. That's the most protein that will help, that will go to developing her eggs. Remember, she's not eating as an adult, so she has to live only on her reserves and what she can get from the males. Now, in the species they've tested, the males will mate more than once, as the females will. And so as the season goes on, the male's nuptial gift becomes smaller because they're not feeding, so they don't replenish it as much. And males will succumb to predators because there are predators out there. So there'll be fewer and fewer males. So then at the towards the end of their season, the females are not choosy, but they'll answer to any male at all, because then the numbers have shifted, so now there's more females than males. But she still wants to mate because she will take any nuptial gift she can get at this time.
And so it sounds like both males and females mate numerous times?
In most of the fireflies that have been studied, yes. Not all of them, but many of them.
You know, this is kind of jumping off of fireflies into a sort of a larger metaphysical question or something, but I'm just, no matter what creature we're talking about, I'm always continually stunned by how extraordinarily wondrous the natural world is. It's just, all these things you're telling me, it's like, I have a good friend I just had lunch with yesterday he's a biologist, and we talk often about, like, sharks. We're sitting by the ocean talking about sharks the other day. And he was talking about how shark skins are rough, which, because of the way they pass through water, allows them to actually, it makes a turbulent layer right next to the skin, allows them to swim much faster. And, you know, I'm not religious or anything like that, but it's like I said, there is such intelligence in nature. And he turned back to me and he said, there is great intelligence in time. And I just love that, in terms of, you know, billions of years of evolution leads to these great, wonderful, beautiful, complex series of interactions. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Yeah, that's certainly happening with fireflies because they are evolving fairly rapidly because of the predation by these other fireflies. But I feel the same way. You know, I tell people there's no such thing as a boring organism. If it's alive, if it's survived, it has an amazing story to tell. The problem is we don't know most of the stories, and they don't give them up very easy. It takes years of research for us to learn these stories. And then we learn them, we put them in a book, and someone reads them and says, oh, you know, this is so easy to learn about these things because it's here in a book. But they don't give up their stories easy, but there is no such thing as a boring creature. There's something interesting about everything.
So, thank you for that, and sorry for this being such a basic question, but you've talked about the females being on the ground. Do they not fly at all, or do they not generally fly?
There are three different groups of fireflies. You can group them this way. The first group is the fireflies that we think of as fireflies, the ones that fly around and flash. And in most of these, not all of them, most of them, the females have fully functional wings and they can fly. And the males fly and flash and the females respond to them. The second group we call glowworms. And in the glowworms, the males can fly. In many cases, they've lost the ability to flash, and the females look like the larvae, and they either have no wings or very small, non-functional wings, and they can't fly, and they'll walk around and glow, and there's still some question whether it's the glowing, not a time flash, but just a constant glow for a certain amount of time, whether that's attracting the male, or if they're also releasing pheromones. And then the third group of fireflies, both the males and the females can glow, but neither of them, the adults, can produce light. And they come out during the daytime, and they use pheromones to attract a mate. And the thinking of this is that they have evolved this kind of lifestyle, the daytime lifestyle, to avoid the Photurus predation. Since Photurus is the main predator, if you come out during the daytime, when the Photurus is not out, you don't have to worry about these predators. These daytime fireflies, the couple that have been studied, also have the poison, and they also will reflex bleed, and they look like fireflies, so they are protected from predators, but they don't have to worry about the Photurus. And then there's one firefly that we have here. It's called the winter firefly, which has taken it even further. So this firefly is one of the daytime fireflies. Neither of the adult female or male light up. But they will hatch as adults in the fall. And once they hatch, they fly to a communal tree, usually a tree like a white oak with a thick bark, and wedge their way into the bark and spend the winter there. So these fireflies actually are adults during the winter, the cold winter up here in New England. They're completely hidden in the trees. And then in the first warm day of the late winter, early spring, they come out and they walk around in the trees and they try to find a mate on the tree. They will actually use their antenna to touch other insects, and if they find the right chemicals on the back of that insect, they know it's one of these fireflies. So they have a totally different lifestyle. So, you know, it's amazing the way evolution is really driving these changes. But so some fireflies, females can fly, and some can't.
So I'm guessing your answer to this next question is going to be, we don't have research on this yet, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So if there's a firefly population somewhere and they are a circumscribed population and now new territory opens up to them, how are they at re-inhabiting that new territory? Can they move in pretty well?
Well, you're right in one respect. We don't have the information on that. However, one could make a guess. They don't fly very fast or very far, so my feeling is they're not migrating to different places very easily. We get asked that question all the time. How do I introduce fireflies to my area, my yard? How do I make it good for fireflies? And there are things you can do to make your backyard or your habitat you know, more acceptable to fireflies. For instance, don't use pesticides on your lawn, keep your lights off, leave some areas natural. But then it may take a while for fireflies to move into that area. The other thing the other question we get asked all the time is, how come people don't sell fireflies so you can repopulate an area? Well, first of all, they're not very easy to raise. Beetles are notoriously hard to raise in any large numbers, and very few people have raised fireflies from egg to adult. It's not that easy to do. And then the second problem with that is there are so many different fireflies here in the U.S. that you would have to get the right type of firefly for that particular habitat. And most people have no idea what the right type of firefly habitat is for a firefly. One of the problems with fireflies is they all look the same. So even the experts have a hard time identifying a firefly by looking at it. So one way that we identify them is by the flash pattern. But the problem with that is there's no record that I know of all the flash patterns of all the fireflies. We don't have range maps of all the fireflies, so we don't know which ones necessarily are in an area. And the third problem is fireflies slow down when it gets cold, and that includes their flash, so their flash timing is off. And so when people say, you know, I want to learn to identify fireflies, they say, well, imagine if you have a bird guide that has some of the birds in it, not all of them. There's no map, so you don't know which ones are where. And when the color, when the temperature changes, when you get a temperature change, the colors of the pictures change. Could you identify birds very well doing that? The answer is no. So most people don't identify fireflies. The way the experts do it is like they would identify many insects as looking at the male reproductive organs, which we don't encourage our volunteers to do.
So I once again, when I was doing the research for this, I was reading about a conservation program in Japan, that there was a firefly who was very popular as a pet, and so the population really collapsed because they sold them like crazy and caught them like crazy. But then they were able to do a fairly successful conservation program. Do you know about that?
A little bit about that. And I believe it's the firefly that lives along river areas. And they are one of these fireflies where the larvae is aquatic. And they eat snails. And this is a pretty wide-ranging firefly in many parts of Asia, I believe. And they were able to raise these fireflies and reintroduce them with some success. That's never been done here in the U.S. with our type of fireflies. But with that type, they have been able to do it. In fact, there's one insect breeder who breeds a lot of butterflies and sells to museums and zoos that is starting a firefly breeding program of this one particular firefly. And hopefully, he hopes to be able to supply these in large numbers to exhibits, science museums and nature museums. But it's not an American firefly. It is this particular firefly where it's been well studied and they know how to raise them in large numbers.
So, you know, I'm a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and I work with activists, you know, all over the world. And just, you know, like I mentioned, I think before the interview started, that just a couple days ago I interviewed someone about koalas, and one of the first questions was, tell me about koalas, and she was saying, you know, I love koalas, but the real question is habitat. And then we got into a brief discussion about how much easier it is to try to protect a charismatic megafauna than, you know, a creature who is not cute and cuddly. But so this is all a preamble to the question of, if fireflies evoke such tremendous positive feelings in so many people, why do you think that there has been so little research done and also so little sort of overt legislative protection? I mean, because you can't get much more charismatic, really, than a firefly.
No, that's true. And for the first question is, why is there so little research and so few researchers? It probably has to do with the way people you'd have, you know, the type of study you have to do. First of all, your season is fairly short. Second of all, you're out every night. And, you know, and third, you are sharing firefly territory with mosquito territory. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to a few researchers and gone out with them in their nightly research, and they are all covered up from mosquitoes in the hottest part of the summer. And, you know, they're out there from, you know, from dusk to dawn in many cases every night studying them. So I think that is one reason why there's not a lot of people studying them. Also, there's no money in studying them. You know, a lot of money for studying anything with insects is about how to control them, not how to encourage them. So that's probably why there aren't that many firefly researchers. Hopefully, we're bringing fireflies back into the consciousness of the people through our program and lots of other programs. So hopefully that will change, but it's an uphill battle. As far as why there's not a lot of legislation, people have talked about trying to do something about light pollution. Another problem is spraying for insects, and now with problems like the Zika virus and they're spraying for mosquitoes, you know, that's certainly, you weigh that against the enjoyment of fireflies, and people tend to want to get rid of the mosquitoes. But what I tell people when they ask why study fireflies, I say, if there's a problem with the environment in your area and all the crane flies in the world in your backyard disappeared, would you notice that? And they say, what's a crane fly? Well, if all the fireflies...
Which, by the way, breaks my heart, the fact that you say that.
Yeah, mine too, but we know what crane flies are. But if all the fireflies disappear, would you notice that? And people say yes. So I think fireflies are a great way to get people to start thinking about the environment and the problems in the environment, but also the problems that they might be causing in their own backyard to something they love. So hopefully fireflies could become a sort of a symbol like the koala has in areas. But we have a lot, you know, they're an insect, and we have a long way to go to make them popular enough to make a difference.
So we have about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you sort of a 10-minute wind-down question, then a 5-minute wind-down question in a couple minutes. The 10-minute wind-down question is, so can you tell me about the history of the Firefly Watch program? Did you come up with it? Did somebody else come up with it? How did they come up with it? And how did it start? And then what are some of the, insofar as you can tell, what's some of the preliminary information that you're getting?
It started in 2006, 2007. A woman at the Museum of Science, Maureen McConnell, was interested in starting some citizen science projects at the museum as a way to get our members more interested, more involved in science. Rather than just having us tell them about science, they could actually get involved in a program. This was back before the big boom in citizen science, when there weren't all that many citizen science projects. So she asked me if there was a project I would be interested in doing, and I thought about it. And around that time, I was introduced to a mutual friend, this young man named Adam South, who was a graduate student studying fireflies at Tufts University. And so I went out to talk with him, and we thought about fireflies and how little was known. And then it occurred to me that we could start a citizen science project on fireflies, because not much was known. There's a lot to be learned. Everyone loves them. It should be easy to get people to participate. So that's how we got the idea. The first year, 2008, we thought we'd start off small. We thought if we got 100 people participating in Massachusetts, that would be great. And then we could sort of learn how to do this, because it was all new to us. I put out word about the project to bird clubs and watershed organizations just in Massachusetts. And by the end of the summer, we had 700 people in 34 states. So we were pretty surprised that it really caught on that well. But people would tell their relatives, their friends, they would tell the newspapers, and so the word spread. And so every year we probably have a little over 1,000 people participating. Some people have done it every year. Some people do it for 1 or 2 years and then move on. So we've been collecting quite a bit of data. However, what we found was firefly numbers varied greatly from year to year. So it's sort of like looking at temperature data. You could look at 5 years and say, oh, it's just going up and down and up and down. But over a long period of time, you'll see the trend go up as it is in temperature, and we expect down over a long period of time in fireflies. So we haven't really spent a lot of time yet looking at the data. I'm more interested in the education because I'm an educator, not a scientist, but I want to teach people about fireflies and get them interested in natural history through fireflies and conservation through fireflies. But still the data is there, and we are having people starting to look at the data. But it will take a long time for us to really tell anything concrete. One of the things that happens in our firefly project is anybody can sign up for it, and there's no real training except what's online. So we get people that are very competent. They could be scientists in their own right. We can get kids doing that. We can get people that are not at all conversant with computers and make mistakes all the time. We get this wide range of data. So we have to look at it very carefully with that in mind.
You know, I just have to say that had this existed, I grew up in Colorado. But had this existed and had I grown up instead in Missouri or Nebraska and obviously moved the technology back for, 50 years, I have absolutely no doubt that this is something that my mom would have been having me doing. This would have been just such a fabulous project for a kid.
Mm-hmm. I tell people, I say that people know three things about fireflies. They come out at night. They blink and people like them, and that's all they know. And when I do programs in fireflies, people are so surprised that there's more than one type of firefly. But then when they learn the natural history, they are totally amazed at these creatures that they have loved all their life but really knew nothing about. And so, I'm very excited that we can teach people that natural history is fascinating. It's just that it takes time to learn these things.
So let's be explicit before we go to the last wind down question. Let's be explicit about how do people, okay, so let's say I am in Missouri and let's say I want to do this. What precisely do I do? Like, give me the website and everything.
Sure. The website is, if you just do a search for Firefly Watch, that's the easiest way. You'll come up with the website. It's on a legacy server, but if you just do a search for Firefly Watch, you'll come up with the website, and there will be a place where you can just, it'll tell you to sign in or sign up. And when you sign up, what you do is you pick a name for your site. You locate it on the Google map. You answer the questions that I mentioned earlier. How often do you mow? Do you put down your fertilizers, pesticides? What's the main type of vegetation? Just a series of questions. It's all done online. Then once a week during firefly season, you would go outside and look for fireflies and count the number you see in 10 seconds. As I said, it's 0, 1, 2 to 5, 6 to 20, or more than 20. And then you answer a few specific questions, like what the color of the flash is. Since some fireflies flash yellow-green, some flash green, some flash orange, and there's even one that will give a blue color. Is it flying or is it sitting? Are they... is it a single flash, double, triple flash? And then answer some questions about the weather for that particular night. And we like our volunteers to do that once a week, but we'll take any information we can get. We'd like them to do it for many, many years, but again, as long as people want to do it, we have some people that do it 1 year, some people that do it many years.
That's great. So I guess the last question would be, once again, we don't have the information on this, but what, apart from turning off lights and not using pesticides, which are pretty obvious, what else do fireflies need? What do they need from us?
Well, I would say, other than those two things, leave some of the areas natural. Many of the fireflies that I see here in my yard will crawl up onto the bushes, the females will, and the males will find them on the low bushes or the high bushes. Some will mate in the tops of trees. So, the more natural the area can be, so it's not just solid grass, fireflies would have a hard time, I would imagine, finding the way under the grass if it's, a heavy, thick thatch. So just let some areas grow natural, no pesticides, no lights. Provide moisture if you can, and then just hope for the best.
Thank you. Is there anything else you want to say about this that I haven't given you opportunity?
So much more to say about fireflies, but I think two things I would like to say. It's definitely worth this book, Dr. Sarah Lewis's book on silent sparks. It's a wonderful book with a lot more information than I've given. And also, there are quite a few environmental centers now that are hosting firefly festivals. For instance, I went to one in New Jersey earlier this summer. It was a two-night festival where last year they had 3,000 people come to this festival in 2 nights. And we have a page in our website listing festivals, and it's a great way to get out and learn about fireflies and also meet people who are interested in fireflies as well. So, you know, if you're interested, check out our website on our programs and festivals page.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Don Salvatore. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.